welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And our special guest today is Duncan Lunan. Because for those of you who heard the first interview we did with Duncan about a year ago, we left the interview hanging on a true cliffhanger because Duncan began to relate the story of the Green Children of Woolpit. And since then, Duncan has been finalizing his book, finishing his book, and has now seen the publication of his book on the Green Children of Woolpit. And so, first of all, Duncan, before we delve into that story, congratulations and welcome back on the show.
Thank you for both. It's good to be back with you.
Now, for those people who haven't heard or are new to the subject, what is briefly the intrigue, the mystery, the beauty of the Green Children of Woolpit?
Right. The village of Woolpit is 8 miles, roughly, east of Bury St Edmunds in the county of Suffolk in East Anglia. And in the period that we're talking about, in the latter part of the 12th century, it was an aspiring market town on the major pilgrim route in England from Ipswich to the shrine of St. Thomas, shrine of St. Edmund at Canterbury, St. Thomas a Becket's martyrdom and canonization was still to come. In this village, so we're told by two reliable chroniclers, two children came out of an ancient earthwork at harvest time, wearing clothing of quote a colour and material never seen before, and speaking a language nobody recognised, despite the location. The two chronicles are written independently, and there's no collusion between them. They tell the story from different viewpoints, but most of the facts are the same in both. And the key thing, as far as those writers were concerned, was that the children, initially at least, were green all over. And apparently, they were at first put on some kind of exhibition. It was found out that they were green all over very rapidly. It was some time before people noticed that they were sickening and might possibly need to eat, and then wouldn't eat anything they were offered. At which point, common sense kicked in, and they were taken to the home of a knight called Richard de Calne. In subsequent events, the boy sickened and eventually died. The girl grew up and married, but in the both of them having lost the green colour, but in the meantime, being at what turns out to have been a formal hearing prior to their christening, they were questioned quite intensively about their origins, and they gave an account of life on a planet which is definitely not Earth, and of some kind of instantaneous transmission from there to here, which had put them in the pit, in Woolpit. And because it very definitely wasn't Earth, Robert Burton recognised that, and he put it in 1621 in the astronomy section of the Anatomy of Melancholy, which is where I discovered it when I was a student. And I always intended to do something about it. And when I started researching it in depth in 1993, I found that there was, in fact, a great deal more to the story than just that basic outline I've given you, which is what most writers begin with and end with.
And that basic outline already has caused controversy and is the subject of intense debate, because what we're confronted with here is not something which, you know, it's not like a UFO sighting in the sense of like, oh, somebody saw something and whatever it is, it might be. These were two flesh and blood human beings who one of them had offspring later. We'll come to that. This was a big thing, and it went up to the highest levels of authority in England, if not Europe, if not the world.
It did indeed. It turns out, well, I found that Richard de Calneau was very difficult to locate, and this explains why most writers have just simply assumed that he was the lord of the manor locally, and where he's described as a certain kind of knight. This probably meant that he was a man of little consequence, a masterless knight, a sword for hire, basically. But none of these things are true. De Calneau was a member of a very powerful family, whose members were very highly placed both in the church and the state. His great uncle, for instance, had been Bishop of Salisbury and Chancellor of England, and even regent for a time when Henry I was out of the country. And his father was the bishop, had been Chancellor and then became Bishop of Ely. His half-brother became Bishop of London. His uncle was the Bishop of Norwich. And it goes on like that. And even more remarkably, in one of the earliest records of him, we find that he's already being excused the Danegeld tax, which tells you he's working for the king. And after the civil war between Stephen and Matilda, he and the English head of the Knights Templars, the provincial master, together excused all taxes explicitly because of their service to the crown, Henry II being the king by that time. And so this is why de Calneau is invisible, because he's not on the record from then on. He's like the head of the Secret Service. He pays no taxes, so his where he lives and what he does, there's virtually no record of. But he was obviously a man of great influence. It turns out also that it was expected that something big would happen in Woolpit. Henry II had already annexed the village which belonged to Bury St Edmunds Abbey, and he was supposedly this was to give it to one of his poor clerks who needed the income of £10 a year, but in fact the quote poor clerk was the vice chancellor of the time, who was just about the richest man in the country. For him to assign the village to somebody of that degree of importance means that there is something special going on there. And then, during his own civil war, when his sons and his wife rebelled against him in alliance with the kings of France and Scotland, suddenly he breaks off from the defence of Normandy, rushes across the Channel for 4 weeks, 4 days, I beg your pardon, forward and back. And then as far as one can tell from the record, the only thing that he does is that he puts a crack garrison of top-ranking troops, probably Knights Templar, into the castle next to Woolpit. And while all of this is going on, a chap called Samson de Bottington, the future abbot of Bury St Edmunds, has been, by his own account, interfering and trying to get the king to give the village back, and trying to get the Pope to order the king to give it back. And he tells a great story in his biography of all the tribulations that he went through trying to achieve this. But when you look at what actually happened, the letter which he brought back from Rome, which is addressed to the abbot and not to the king, actually says, concerning the village of Woolpit, we have ordered that the king is to return it to you when he has finished with it, which is a completely different matter, because it tells you that that something is going on there, and B, that the king is very much involved in it, and C, that the Pope is at least aware of what is happening, even if he has no direct hand in it. So all of this, as you say, you know, two steps away from Woolpit, and you're moving in the highest circles.
So let me just clarify this, because this is the piece that this involvement of the king and the importance of Woolpit, I think, is so critical to this story. And I want to back up just for a second and let our audience know that Philip and I had the extraordinary pleasure and privilege of being in Woolpit very recently with Duncan and his lovely wife. And Duncan showed us a lot of these places, and it's one of those places that there is something very powerful about the location. I mean, when you are there, you feel this is a special place. Now, I just want to be clear. Are you saying that there had been some kind of understanding that something important was going to happen in Woolpit before the children appeared?
It very much appears so. It is as if the it is as if the incident with the children was an accident, and it gives us a glimpse of something much bigger that is happening. There's another story which at first glance just sounds like a folk tale, but turns out not to be, because it has direct links with the Woolpit story, and it concerns a castle in Derbyshire and the cavern beneath it, the peak cavern, where the swineherd who worked for the lord of the castle went into the cavern looking for a missing sow, and came out at harvest time in a place that sounds very much like Woolpit. The people there were not surprised by his appearance, and basically said to him, "If that's your pig, take it back. The boss wants it out of here." And so he did, and went back the way he came. And it seems, the evidence is circumstantial, but it seems that this story came to the attention of Henry II round about the time in 1160 when he laid claim to the village of Woolpit, when he suddenly said, "I am taking this away from the church, and I'm putting one of my most senior people in charge of it." That seems to have followed from when the Peveril incident was reported to him. So yes, it does appear that both of these incidents are part of something much bigger, and that the king was, if not directly involved, he was certainly taking a great interest in it.
But he would become directly involved, because you found two references to meetings which he had with the girl Agnes.
Yes. Two different kings, I think you're thinking of, but in the first instance, Agnes, I believe to be the girl, because she's part of the extended De Calne household, but not a member of the family, and all the circumstances tie in, the inheritance that she received from the family, and who was in charge of it, and who she married, apparently De Calne's godson, who was one of Henry II's senior ambassadors. All of this is all putting Agnes in the frame as being the green girl who we know remained in De Calne's household into adult life before she married. But before she married, she had an illegitimate son whom it appears she rejected. And her husband-to-be, Richard Barr, made himself responsible for the boy, arranged for his upbringing with his family's neighbours in Staffordshire. He kept Agnes herself, in ignorance about his whereabouts and all the rest of it. And it wasn't until many years later that the two of them found out, in effect, who they were. A couple of historian friends of mine suggested to me that this and the massive promotion which Richard Barr attained round about the same time all implies that the child was Henry II's, that he had fathered this boy upon Agnes, quite possibly against her will, and that was why she had rejected him, but that Richard Barr had been put in charge of his upbringing and making sure that he was looked after. And I thought that was completely fanciful, until I dug into the records deeply enough to find out where Henry was 9 months earlier at the Beltane Festival, when it was traditional for the Lord of the Forest ceremonially to deflower a virgin, and the king was the ultimate Lord of the Forest in medieval England. It would be entirely in character for him to do this, because of the interest he had in the supernatural and all and the paranormal generally, as we would call it nowadays. And, bless me, he was staying on De Calne's manor on the night of Beltane the previous year, which puts him right in the frame, and very strongly suggests that the child was his. The other incident is right at the far end of Agnes's life, in 1238, which is the last historical record of her. Just about that time, Henry III goes and stays on the larger manor of which her holdings were a part. And presumably he went to see her on her deathbed, which again tells you that she's somebody important. It's a remarkable coincidence if the king of the time just happened to be there when she was in her last year. It looks much more to me as if it's significant.
Absolutely, and that is her death. But we know nothing about her birth, but we do know when she arrived. And as you would expect, the sudden arrival of two children out of nowhere, who don't speak the language, is going to cause some kind of effect in the local community and the larger community. So what happened? We have these two children appearing out of nowhere. How were they welcomed? How were they taken? How were they basically becoming part of this community? Because, as we know, she became a somewhat ordinary citizen.
Yes, well, in the first instance, their first year of life was pretty disturbed, especially the events immediately following their arrival, before they ended up under the care of de Calne. But we've been into that already. It is striking that when the villagers did take the children to de Calne, rather than to the Abbot of Bury St. Edmunds, to whom you would think they would still owe loyalty, even if technically they were no longer his servants. But they didn't go to the Abbot. They went to de Calne in a completely different direction, and about twice as far, and crossing the land of two other barons to get to him. All of which tells you this was purposeful. Now, even in de Calne's household, they would not eat anything they were offered, and nearly starved to death before green beans happened to be brought into the house. And recognizing the colour, they indicated by signs that they wanted those. They didn't know which part of the plant was edible, and they had to be shown that the food was in the pods. And then, for a long time afterwards, they would eat nothing else. And interestingly enough, the Latin word for the boy's condition, is that he died of exhaustion or depression. Mm-hmm. But depression is the primary meaning of the word. And green beans contain a compound called tyramine, which accentuates melancholia. Depressives are urged not to eat them. And he lived on nothing else for a considerable period, and this presumably helped to explain his decline. But Agnes seems to have been made of sterner stuff and perhaps was more willing to try food that she didn't recognise once her initial fears or conditioning had been overcome. And having lost the green colour and having gone through the hearing and been christened, the next glimpse we have of her, which comes from the other chronicle, she is living as a member of de Calne's household and described as greatly wanton and lascivious, which has two possible interpretations. One is that this is a dig at the business with the king and the illegitimate child. But the other thing is, if the king had made her even unofficially a ward, de Calne would have had to provide a dowry, find a husband for her and provide a dowry, unless she was unchaste. And here he is making a point of saying in public that she's not chaste, which may just be that as an old man, as he was by then, he's getting mean. But anyway, whatever.
Well, from the point of view of women's history, I always find that very interesting. As soon as it comes out publicly that a woman is unchaste or wanton in her behavior, that usually says to me, this is a really important woman and you want to pay attention.
Yes, quite possibly, yes, that there's money involved as well. But something that everybody gets wrong is that she is described as in ministerial productimilitis, which is in the service of the aforesaid knight. And as far as I can see, everybody prior to me has taken this to mean that she was actually a domestic servant. In Glenn Maxwell's play about the Green Children, De Carna actually sentences her to scrubbing floors because she's not sharing her favours with him. But it's not that at all. If you look at the categories of feudal service, ministerial, the same word that gives us ministry in the sense of government ministry, you know, it's administrative work. She is running things for De Carna. She's in a much more influential position, possibly in charge of one or more of his estates, or taking over the running of his household as his wife becomes elderly. And the other thing is, just to back that up, as I learned from a history book quite recently, the quote, the medieval serving wench is a Hollywood invention. The domestic staff of households at that time was exclusively male. And the only women servants were people like brewmistresses and washerwomen who came in from outside and were regarded as disruptive influences. And the guides to being a good servant are full of warnings not to get involved with the women who come into the house because it disturbs the good order of things and spoils your chances of promotion. So she can't have been a domestic servant. There simply weren't any female domestic servants resident in households in De Carna's time.
And that makes her, you know, stand out. This is a woman who is remarkable to all extent. But the question then becomes, like, what do we know as to where they came from? And are we right in even assuming that the boy was her brother, or do we not even know that?
Well, we're told that he was her brother. And in fact, under questioning, the children said that they had been out with their father's livestock. So I think we can assume, yes, they were brother and sister. Where the story on this level becomes extraordinary is where they're being questioned by the bishop, and they've obviously been coached in what answers to give, which tells you there are onlookers for whose sake, at least on the surface, things have to take the certain
because,
course.
Because just to interrupt you briefly here, they were basically illegal aliens at that moment in time. They had no paperwork, nobody knew who these kids were.
That's right. And in fact, at this point, again, the exact Latin wording is critical. The language becomes formal. She swore on oath, and they gave evidence of that. And I called a friend of mine who has a diploma in theology from the Roman Catholic College of Cardinals and said to him, "What's that about?" And he said, "Oh, everybody knows that." I said, "Well, I don't. Tell me." And he said, "Even today in the Roman Catholic Church, a christening in controversial circumstances must be preceded by an inquisitio, with a small I, which is a formal hearing conducted by a bishop." Now, the children are asked by the bishop who and from whence they are. And this next bit is very clever. They reply, "We are people of the land of St. Martin." The best bluffs are done in plain sight. In the Doomsday Book, in block capitals, Terra Sancti Martini, the land of St. Martin, is the ethics property of the Church of St. Martin's Le Grand, which stood next to St. Paul's and was the principal sanctuary in England, the only church which could grant permanent sanctuary. And this tells us, firstly, that it's the Bishop of London who's conducting the hearing, and secondly, that we are people of the land of St. Martin is not where do you come from, it's who are you. We are people who are already under your protection.
And I just want to interrupt and say this is important because this is one of the things that skeptics use against the argument of these children being from a potentially supernatural place, right? I mean, skeptics say, oh, well, they say they come from St. Martin's Land, therefore they must be, you know, contemporaneous to the Middle Ages, or they came from a, you know, an explainable place if they're talking about Jesus and St. Martin, right?
Yeah, well, the next bit, of course, is do they believe in our Savior there? And the girl gives the answer she's been told to give, which is, oh, yes, the land is full of churches. But in adult life, as the other chronicle recounts it, she didn't bother saying any of that. This was clearly just for the purposes of the hearing. But at that point, when she's very nearly home free, the last question was, does the sun rise or set there? And all she has to say is yes, because medieval belief was that there was no sun in fairyland, because it was underground. And all she has to do is say, yes, the sun does, and she says, no, it doesn't. She lived in a land of permanent twilight, separated by a very broad river from a land of permanent sunlight. And this is what Burton realized could not apply anywhere on Earth, and caused him to suggest that the children had possibly come from Mars or Venus, because it is another planet, a planet apparently keeping the same face always towards its sun, the way the moon keeps the same face always towards the Earth. Trapped rotation is the term for this. And that appears to be what they were describing. However, she gets away with that. And I picture de Calna and Richard Barr walking out of the hearing at the end going, after that, we'll have to call her Agnes. Because the thing about St. Agnes was she was the girl they couldn't burn. When they tried to burn St. Agnes, the faggots wouldn't light. And although St. Agnes was put to death, our Agnes has got away with us, and probably at that point changed her mind about what she was going to be christened.
And she was, you know, she came as a green child, the little green man and a little green girl is basically extremely applicable to them, not necessarily from Mars, but they are otherwise apparently completely human. She was able to procreate. There is, I think, nothing in the record which suggests that somehow, apart from the green collar, she was, not human in appearance. So, what happened to the green collar, and what do you think the green collar was?
Well, the girl herself, in Balfour Coggeshall's account of her, is asked about this, and her reply is that all of the people and all things in that land are dyed with the same green colour. Now, the way it is phrased, I think all things is meant here to relate to all plants and not the animals, but I could be wrong about the animals, but definitely I think the implication here is very strongly that it was a dye, a vegetable dye, because essentially, there is no medical condition that turns people green. I wasted a lot of time trying to pin down a condition called chlorosis, which supposedly turns young women green, but it turns out that it never did. And in fact, it's a generic name from the early Industrial Revolution for the condition of young women suffering from what we would now call, among other things, we would now call anorexia nervosa. Nobody actually had a patient who turned green. Chlorosis, in fact, is a disease that doesn't exist. And essentially the only thing that does turn people green is acute retention of bile products, and it's a sign of imminent death, which very clearly was not the condition in which the children arrived, because they survived quite an extended period of difficulty. So I think we have to believe her and say, yes, the people have dyed green with something they take from the plants. And it is probably, I think, I'm guessing, But it's just a possible reading of one of the Latin phrases that's used, that there could be something that comes over the river and hunts. Richard Dawkins' chapter on predator eyesight in A River Out of Eden is very revealing here about how specialized predator eyesight is. And polar bears only hunt in a certain season because that's their lifestyle. And lions hunt at a preferred time of day, and so do other big cats. And this is because they have adapted to that, to the extent that they're at a disadvantage with an eyesight if they hunt at other times. So putting two and two together and getting 12 here, I think probably it's a case that if you're dyed green and the same color as the plants and you stand still, you have a much better chance of survival if something comes. And so that's my guess as to what the significance of it is.
And so we have two green children who appear out of nowhere in 12th century England. You've described it as medieval X-Files, and it definitely is an extremely apt description for this. It attracts the attention of the king. The Pope is at least aware, if not more involved. There are Knights Templars dashing about.
Mm-hmm. De Calne himself was almost certainly an associate Templar, and that fits with the bit about him being a certain kind of knight.
Mm-hmm. And then there is another incident, a strange one, in which Templars seem to be kind of appearing out of nowhere and disappearing into nowhere, suggesting that strange things are happening in England in the 12th century.
In fact, I think, again, when I found this one out, which was the first time I visited Coggeshall Abbey, I was absolutely flabbergasted when the curator said, "I've got an old report about the Abbey here you might like to read." And this was in it. About 2 years after the boy died, a party of Knights Templars were discovered inside the guest house of the Abbey, without any apparent way of having got there. They hadn't come in through the gates, and it would have been very difficult to get there by any other means without being seen. Even more strangely, they then seem to have gotten themselves to out of the guest house and to the, which is on the south of the church, and into the cemetery on the north of the church, without having gone through the intervening space, and there isn't any way round. There's no way round on the east, and you can't get round on the west without being seen from the gate. And yet somehow they did it, and then got out again, unseen. And the most obvious explanation you might think is they went over the wall, but that was actually an excommunication offence for a Templar to leave a house over a wall. It's specifically mentioned in the rules as something they are never to do, and there's something that it means they're up to no good. The leader of the party, in the conversation he had with the monk who discovered them, specifically identified himself as a Templar master, which tells you something big is going on. And my guess is that they were retrieving the boy's body. It's a guess, but given that it's only 2 years after the boy died, and the other circumstances surrounding it, it's very likely that he was buried at Coggeshall Abbey. And what else in the cemetery would have interested the senior Templar so much? And it's not the only incident. In the 12th century, we have two incidents in the same year where parties of Templars are seen appearing and disappearing out of thin air, first in Yorkshire and then in Ireland. And once again, when you dig into the history of the places, it turns out that there are direct links back to Woolpit and to people who were in Woolpit at the time of the Green Children's appearance. Everything joins up. and it all seems to be one big story.
So going back to this idea that Henry II and those immediately near to him, and I think that referring to de Calne as the head of the Secret Service paints a really important picture here. What do you think it is or was about Woolpit specifically that made them know that something was going to happen here?
Well, my continuing to guess, this takes us to the question of exactly how the children came to be in the pit. How did it happen? The account in one of the chronicles is clearly fictitious. It says that they arrived by wandering through a network of caves. Woolpit stands on Pleistocene clay, and the water table is very near the surface, so much so that in medieval times, buildings didn't have foundations. They were built on wooden sleepers. It is simply impossible to have a network of underground caves linking Woolpit to anywhere else. Far more interestingly, when they were children, the account they gave of it was that because they were out with their father's livestock on a certain day, there's very strong causative construction in Latin that really tells you that if they hadn't been out with the livestock that day, this would not have happened to them. It was because they did that, probably against orders. They suddenly heard a great sound of bells, which they later compared to the sound of bells at Bury St Edmunds, but made it clear that it was like that and not the same. And then suddenly, as if placed in some absence of mind, we found ourselves in the field where you were reaping. And I think that sentence is fascinating. Not only does this kid, who at this point has to be around about 10 years old, not only does she know what amnesia is, but she knows she hasn't got it, as if placed in some absence of mind. And to me, this very strongly indicates that they're at least from an advanced society, and that she knew what had happened. That they'd brought this accident upon themselves, and that's what it was. It was an accident. But tying it back to your question, why would they know things were going on at Woolpit? My guess is, if someone has used a matter transmitter system to establish a human settlement on another world, it's still going to need supplies from Earth. No, there will be stuff they run out of. And their livestock will need to be replenished and all of this. And Woolpit was presumably one of the termini. There may well have been other incidents that happened there, but that had already drawn the king's attention, or it may have all simply started with the incident of the Peveril swineherd. And at that point, the people who were with Henry II at the time, who were in a position to know what was going on, said to him, "You had better put somebody senior in charge of that place. It's potential trouble." It looks as if things had been going on there for some time, probably for quite a large part of the 12th century.
And so these children are off this planet, somewhere else, appear here, and the question is this a one-off? Is this something which was so unique that it never happened, which makes it extremely bizarre, even more bizarre than it already is? Were there certain conditions which allow this to happen? Because let's face it, children who appear out of nowhere in a story like that, even the X-Files, I think, the X-Files series hasn't even put it on television like that. So is there a framework which would make sense of the fact that out of nowhere two children can appear?
Well, when my late friend Danny Kane was the one who suggested to me that I look at the astronomical records. What else was happening at the time? Particularly what was happening in the sky? And what I discovered was that the skies were extremely disturbed. They're starting from around 1095, there had been an epoch of multiple comets, meteor showers, and particularly huge displays of the aurora borealis and other phenomena indicating disturbances on the sun. Naked eye sunspots were seen at 11-year intervals, but big enough to be seen at sunset or through cloud. But the aurora were extraordinary. They were getting bright red aurora all the way down into the Middle East, down as far as Syria. Normally, we don't even see it as where I am here in Glasgow. It's very rare to see coloured aurora this far south, and they were getting it all over Europe and down the other side of the Mediterranean. The records from tree rings and ice cores confirm this, that the sun was extremely disturbed at the time. And 1173, which seems to be the year the children came, there's a huge spike in solar activity. There are two absolutely enormous auroral storms a few months earlier. And the thing that occurred to me there is that if the children's planet has a trapped rotation, it's turning very slowly on its axis, and probably, like Venus in our solar system, it will, unlike the Moon indeed, and Mercury, will have little or no magnetic field. So I went to a physicist friend of mine and said, if you have got a matter transmitter linking a planet with no magnetic field and a planet whose magnetic field is being seriously disturbed by the sun, can you tell me why that matter transmitter would malfunction? And he said, oh yes, you tell me what makes it go wrong and it's much easier to figure out how it works. And he came back with a description of it. Not something we could build, but something we could use with existing technology, because essentially the key that opens the portal is simply an electrostatic discharge, a capacitor. And the portal opens and you step through it. You walk between worlds. And this seems to be what they had. And that was how it was done. And who set all of this up? Who took people to that other world? When the children talk about all the people that were held in that land, who's holding them? This we are not told.
But you have been identifying other sites in Britain, mm-hmm. which seem to form a pattern or a grid or whatever you want to call it, suggesting that Woolpit was not the only site involved, and that these sites together pushed this story of abduction or whatever you want to call it, of world travel back several thousands of years?
Possibly. Stonehenge is certainly in the pattern, and Avebury to the north of it. The thing about it is that it's not actually a grid. What you get is that the sites where things happen are in straight lines, virtually corridors, a few miles wide, running north to south and extending for hundreds of miles, and there are three of them. At one of the sites at Darlington in North Yorkshire, there you have events which apparently occurred both in the medieval period in 1178 and previously round about 2700 BC, which is contemporary with Stonehenge 1 and the pyramids. And yeah, it does, which is when the sun was extremely disturbed, even more disturbed than it was in the 12th century. And that's the previous peak of it. There was a lesser peak round about, I think about, from memory, about 400 BC. It does look as if this contact may have recurred several times over the last 5,000 years. That there might have been four instances, four, four times in which it happened.
And just to do a little segue here into 2012, we're often told that this solar activity this year or about this year is amazingly complex and big compared to the other solar activity. But actually, it hardly features compared to what was happening in the 12th century or the third millennium.
Indeed, it's way below. It's within the normal range of fluctuations. It's way below the intensity of those prehistoric and medieval events.
Which sort of suggests that rather than the world ending through solar flare activity, when the sun really does flare up, children appear out of nowhere, and galaxies and planets all of a sudden align, which actually kind of is interesting from another point of view, when we're talking about return of gods and so much. But Duncan, you've been going to Woolpit, you've been visiting these places. What to you is the most important revelation or message which this story has for our listeners?
Oh, that's a question. I think it's a fascinating story. I can scarcely believe what I'm looking at, because what we have got here, as it seems, if you take all of the elements in it, and don't just say, well, we can forget that part and dismiss the other, which a lot of experts have said to me. But if you try to explain the whole thing, you end up with abductions, apparently on a large scale, by extraterrestrials unknown, for experimental purposes, with the knowledge, if not the active connivance, of some of the terrestrial authorities. And this is the X-Files. It's the X-Files in the 12th century. And as I say, I find I'm not a particularly credulous person. I don't find that at all easy to believe or get on with, but that is what it appears to be. What message you could take from it, other than keep watching the skies and, even more importantly, keep watching out for strange children? Now, that's a joke. The thing with the children was an accident. No, just I would say, if there's a message to get from it, it is, particularly when the sun is active, look around you and see what's going on.
Because weird things do happen. There's obviously skepticism about this story. One of them I find particularly funny, which is that somehow these children came from Flanders. I grew up in Flanders. I can officially declare that we do not have green children, nor is our language this bizarre that nobody in England would ever be able to decode it. Also, even though it is quite often grey in Flanders, it is not the fact that we never have sunshine. We do have sunshine, and our rivers are not that wide. So that's also, we don't have caves, actually.
What they did have, and there were Flemish communities all over Britain. The extent of Flemish immigration was, in fact, a source of major concern at the time. The kind of fuss you get about immigration now, back then, was very largely directed about against or around the Flemish. But and one of the things that they were making a lot of money out of and making themselves unpopular in some areas with was that they had the secret of permanent green dye, which was elderflowers, and nobody else did. But I assume you can confirm that it's total immersion in green dye is not something you normally do with your children.
It is actually something which maybe Flemish people should have considered at some point, but it definitely never became a custom. No, not at all.
Yeah, it does. As an explanation, it does seem to me very superficial. As you say, the language would have been recognised. The clothing almost certainly would have been recognised, or at least the material would have been recognised. And the big unanswered question, if you start to go down these lines, is if there had been Atlantis community in the area, which fell out with its neighbors and was destroyed. And two children survived that. Why would the Kalmar be interested? And why would the king be interested? And why would the Abbot of Bury St. Edmunds care, or the Bishop of London, or any of these other people? Richard Barr, the king's second most senior ambassador at the time, clearly played some part in it. And if I'm right about Agnes, he married the girl. Why would somebody of his status regard a runaway child, you know, from a small Flemish community as being sufficiently important to merit all this fuss?
And I can also underline that, you know, Flemish people are actually aware of how to eat beans. They don't need to be told how to do that. And we have a quite normal diet. So the symptoms that the children had with food is not really a typically Flemish issue. You might say that if these children somehow came from Africa or something like that, or even the New World, where there were obviously diverse foods there, that would be some sort of an explanation as to why they were not eating. But the Flemish diet was very similar to the English diet and remains so. So that is one of the other things. Now, there are of course stories of otherworldly abductions to magical places, and probably in the British Isles, the most famous ones are the abductions to fairyland. Are there parallels? Are they similar? Are they not at all alike? What is your take on the Woolpit story versus what I would say is the traditional fairy encounter or fairy abduction?
Well, there are some faint echoes. The thing about don't eat, your fairy children, if they come here, shouldn't eat the food or they'll never be able to return. That's a motif you often encounter in folk tales. But what the children had seems to have been much stronger than that. And in fact, it was something which they were asked about at the hearing, because this was outwardly suspicious. Why would they not eat not human food? And Agnes made a very precise reply here. She said that they believed when they arrived that all the food they were shown was incomestibilia, which has a very specific Latin meaning. It's not inedible and it's not poisonous. It is like a command. It is things which are not to be consumed for nourishment. Clearly, they've been given a very strong conditioning to eat only food that they recognise, which, again, to my mind, suggests that they're in some kind of experimental situation in the land that they came from, where there are other forms of life, non-terrestrial life, and for heaven's sake, don't eat that, because it will be either inedible or poisonous. I think there we're again seeing clues. One of the most frustrating things is that William of Newburgh, the chronicler who interviewed the witnesses to the children's arrival, so many witnesses and witnesses of such quality that he became convinced it had actually happened. He said that later on, they gave many more details of the land that they came from to those who were inclined to be curious, but it would be tedious to set them down here. And that is just so frustrating. He is, of course, writing from a religious viewpoint. He begins by expressing his misgivings about this apparent miracle, because he can't see what point of scripture it is supposed to illuminate. And then eventually he says, nevertheless, I've become convinced that this happened, and it's not for me to question God's works. But at the end of his section on remarkable events, he comes back to the story and says, I still really don't understand what that was about. So from his viewpoint, the details of the land that they came from were not important. And as I say, it would be tedious to set them down, but I wish I could find his notebook.
Absolutely. Now, this is a story which is more or less buried in you know, documents which exist, but which aren't necessarily that well studied. You happened to come across it by happenstance. It took you more than a decade to uncover these things. Do you think that somewhere in the record there are similar stories buried? Have you found indications of these? I mean, I know you've had some indications related to this story, but like completely unrelated incidents like this happening somewhere else in Britain, France, or anywhere else on the earth.
I have. It takes us in a very different direction, though. My best friend, the late Chris Boyce, was very keen for me to pursue this angle, and I did. I discovered that there were some other strange instances of children coming out of, as it seems, out of nowhere. But the uncanny thing there is they are so similar that it takes you in the direction of time travel. And I decided in the end simply to leave that chapter out of the book, because it complicates things enormously if there is a time travel element in this story, or even if it's all time travel. If you start thinking that the events may have happened to the characters in a different order from the one in which they appear in the historical record, the complexity that you get into is nightmarish. But it is possible, and I dare say someday there might be another book in that.
But the book you have written right now and which has just come out is called Children from the Sky. It is available from Amazon.com. You also have a website called childrenfromthesky.com.
All true. We welcome inquiries. And my wife and I run a club called Astronomers of the Future. We welcome new, which is online, and we welcome new members. The publisher of Children from the Sky is Mutis Liber, from in Edinburgh.
If you want to listen to this interview again, you can do so in a number of ways. You can go to our website, spiritrevolution.com. You can go to the BBS archives at bbsradio.com, where for a small fee you can listen to this show, all our previous ones, but also several of the other shows which appear on BBS Radio. And you can also go to iTunes, where for free you can download more than a year and a half of our shows right to your electronic listening device. And this has been, once again, a wonderful exploration. Duncan, thank you so much for being our special guest this week.
My pleasure.
I just want to jump in here and say that Philip and I were lucky enough to have an advanced copy of Duncan's book and have been able to go through a lot of his material. This story, this book is magnificent. It is so fascinating. It is so well researched. There is so much more information on this story and its potential repercussions than we can ever cram into an hour. But I just want to encourage all of you to pick up this book. You will not regret it, and it will fascinate you and take you into so many different levels of exploration. Children from the Sky.
This has brought us to the end of this week's show. We will be back next week with another show, but in the meantime, from the both of us,
the truth against the world.